Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I was terrified, which was really exciting to me. And to be honest, I hadn't been terrified in a long time. And I think that that is something that I was really, really missing.
Jason Segel is best known for comedies like The Muppets, I Love You Man, and How I Met Your Mother. In the end of the tour, he takes a big leap, playing famed author David Foster Wallace. Segel tells us why he risked it, and director James Ponsoldt explains how he knew Segel would be up to the challenge. But first on the news banter, Crisis at Relativity and Adam Sandler can't save Sony from a bad summer. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, this week, finally, something that Hollywood has been expecting for really a long time, Relativity. And this is a company, an independent company, very hard to start an independent studio. But Ryan Kavanaugh, quite the man about town, you know, known for living large, flying his helicopter from Malibu to Beverly Hills, a couple of DUIs in his past that he managed to get to go away, married to a ballerina and then unmarried and married to a model and hanging around with Leo DiCaprio. So, you know, bright lights, big city kind of guy. Ran this company longer than anybody thought would be possible. And finally, Chapter 11.
Yeah, we had the bankruptcy filing this last week. A list of creditors came out. They checked the box on the filing that said their liabilities are between $500 million and $1 billion, which is probably the largest bankruptcy in Hollywood history. And the list of creditors, this thing has ensnared tons of companies, everyone from Technicolor to media buying firms to Google. They're all listed in this bankruptcy.
Yeah, I mean, people have been wondering what the heck is going on at Relativity for a long time, because it just on paper, at least, even if you don't know the numbers, just sketching on the back of the envelope, looking at these very forgettable, for the most part, movies. I think the one thing I think that people would remember as a quality movie was The Fighter, but also there was, I guess they had The Immortals, which was a sword and sandals movie. They had Limitless, which was known for the advent of Bradley Cooper, other than in Wet Hot American Summer. So other than that, I could name a lot of movies and people would probably scratch their heads and think they'd never heard of them. And you couldn't figure out how they kept going and going and going. Where is the revenue coming from?
Right. And it wasn't just that they kept going, but it was this insistence by Kavanaugh over the years that he had figured it out. He initially put forth this formula that he claimed was the secret to having a hit movie. And, you know, he had an algorithm type thing,
right,
where he knew certain elements and certain creative things would produce a hit movie. And I think a lot of people scratched their head, but he had money behind him. He had, you know, big hedge funds that were involved with him initially. And then he sort of evolved when he launched his own version of Relativity as its own studio. He had different backers. He had what he said was a bulletproof business philosophy where they would not even need to do well in the U.S. Box office-wise, and these movies would pay for themselves. And I think a lot of people scratched their heads, but over the years, there were many media profiles of him that tried to answer that question, and none really did. So now we're getting our first kind of peek under the curtains.
Yes, lots of drooling and slobbering in the press to get a hold of those papers and see. You know, he's already been sued quite recently, and you know, with allegations that he was a con man, and it feels like the linen is about to be aired. There are movies caught up in this, of course, and some of them are getting out. Jane Got a Gun, which is a troubled independent movie, did get out just before the bankruptcy, but other movies they're holding on to, including one with Zach Galifianakis, a pretty high-profile cast that was set to come out earlier. They moved it to October. They didn't have the money to release it. But now it's going to be unclear, you know, what happens going forward. Is this still a company? Will they scale it back and run it? And they being other people who are not Ryan Kavanaugh.
Yeah, the initial filing listed a bunch of creditors, but it really hasn't delved into the actual finances of the company. And on August 13th, they're scheduled to file additional paperwork. So I think then is when we will see, you know, the guts of this company and what money was coming in, what was going out, who was being paid what. I think we'll know a little bit more then.
Meanwhile, we know a little bit more about Sony Pictures. They have had a really bad summer with a bunch of movies left behind by the now-gone co-chairman of the studio, Amy Pascal. Of course, she fell in the wake of the interview, but she could have fallen anyway based on the way these movies are performing. Most recently, Pixels, another Adam Sandler movie that people just didn't really care to see.
Now, it opened to about $24 million in the U.S., did okay overseas, but not great. And this was the centerpiece of Sony's summer, to believe it or not. I mean, they really don't have anything else. And when you see in a summer where Universal is at $1.5 billion for the summer, Sony hasn't released a movie that has made more than $104 million. And that's globally, not just domestic. I mean, they have had just an awful string.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult for Tom Rothman, the new head of the studio, the film studio, to turn it around. We'll watch to see how he does. Meanwhile, the TCAs, the television critics, they're gathered as they do a couple times a year. This time, the big summer gathering to look ahead at fall programming. They've been underway in Beverly Hills. I think probably the thing that's gotten the most attention by a stretch is Trevor Noah, who's going to succeed Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart's in his last little few days of doing the Daily Show. And obviously, Trevor Noah, there was a lot of controversy about tweets that were considered in poor taste, if not worse than poor taste, about Jews, about women, jokes that fell very flat when people started scrutinizing everything he had ever done. He came out in front of the critics and tried to make a really good impression to sort of relaunch himself.
Yeah, he did a secret or semi-secret stand-up set the day before his big panel at TCA just for critics. And this has been part of a slow and methodical rollout plan that Comedy Central has for him. He's essentially trying to win over these people who, frankly, need to be won over. I mean, he got off to such a poor start. He is young. He is untested. He's only 31 years old. And he doesn't, you know, this is a chair that Jon Stewart has turned into a really special place in the comedy and the news world. You know, he had tremendous influence in this job. And I think people are looking at Trevor Noah and saying, okay, kid, what do you got?
Yeah, I think he did make a good impression for the most part. I wasn't there, but this is what we hear from our colleagues who are critics. It's just as well to have them on your side, but of course people will make up their own minds when he starts in September. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. I promise you don't have to have read a single word by author David Foster Wallace to understand the cat and mouse game that is played in the new film, The End of the Tour. The movie is based on a book by David Lipsky, a Rolling Stone journalist who spent 5 days with Wallace in 1996 as the brilliant but troubled writer, then at the height of his career, was on the final leg of a book tour for his behemoth novel, Infinite Jest. As Lipsky attempted to probe his subject, Wallace was, by turns, engaging, brooding, and even angry, letting Lipsky know that he was well aware of the devices the journalist was using to try to disarm him. Lipsky recorded many of their conversations, and though he never did write an article about Wallace for Rolling Stone, he published a book about his road trip with the author that came out a couple of years after Wallace's suicide in 2008. In the end of the tour, Jesse Eisenberg plays Lipsky while Siegel takes on the daunting role of Wallace. Early in the movie, the two men find that they share some bonds over pop culture, as in this exchange, prompted by a poster of singer Alanis Morissette hanging in Wallace's living room.
I mean, she's pretty, all right, but it is like
she is pretty.
The only thing in there.
She's pretty in a very sloppy, very human way. Huh. You know, she's got this like squeaky, orgasmic quality to her voice. Here's what it is. A lot of women in magazines are pretty in a way that is not erotic because they don't look like anybody that you know.
That's true.
Yeah, like you can't imagine them putting a quarter in a parking meter or like eating a bologna sandwich. Whereas Alanis Morissette, I can and have imagined her just like chowing down on a bologna sandwich.
Our guests today are Siegel and director James Ponsoldt, who first encountered Wallace's writing as a teenager and felt an instant connection to the work. Just as Ponsoldt was starting college, Wallace released his most famous and most difficult novel.
You know, the most complicated relationship of my freshman year was engaging with Infinite Jest, but I fell in love with Wallace's writing, and his first collection of essays came out that same year in 97, and I just read everything I could get my hands on, and even when I got married, had some of Wallace's writing read at it. So yes, I was and am a massive fan of David Foster Wallace.
So did you then find the book?
It was interesting. I had read David Lipsky's book, although, of course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, when it came out in 2010, and I loved it, particularly because I loved Wallace's voice, and it comes through loud and clear there. But actually, Donald Margulies...
The playwright.
He was my playwriting professor in college at Yale. We stayed in touch over the years, and he reached out a couple of years ago. Right after I had The Spectacular Now at Sundance, he dropped me an email and just said, "Hey, James, I don't know if you're a David Foster Wallace fan," how little he knew. "And I'm not sure if you know about this book by David Lipsky, but I've adapted it, and Anonymous Content is going to produce it, and I think it's about to be sent your way. And would you give it a read?" And that's how it came to me.
Kismet. Did you say, "I think I could really see this for Ben Stiller," but then you had to get Jason?
No, I mean, on all my movies, like whether it's Spectacular Now or Smash, whatever, I'm really thorough. I mean, I love actors. I love them. And I like meeting a lot of them. And in this case, myself and my producing partners and our casting director, A.V. Kaufman, yeah, we talked about lots of people. But when Jason and Jesse's names came up, they just kind of stuck for all of us. And I mean, I'd been a fan of both of theirs since the beginning of their careers. Jason since Freaks and Geeks, Jesse since Roger Dodger. And it wasn't lost on me that both of those guys are very, very good and very successful writers. To me, in talking to Jason and Jesse, these guys think about scripts, about scenes, and about characters like writers. They just happen to be great actors.
So, Jason, you were a David Foster Wallace person before this, right?
You know, I had read the sort of short-form nonfiction stuff when I got the script. Then I delved into Infinite Jest, and I felt a real kinship with the material. This sort of, how do we reconcile that what we're being told is going to make us feel good seems to leave us feeling empty?
It's such an intimidating person and the book, even. Yeah. I mean, did you pick it up and say, "Oh my God, how many pages are there in this thing?"
When I bought the book at a bookstore, it was like a little indie bookstore, there was a real kind of like ghost world girl behind the counter.
Perfect.
And I set Infinite Jest down, and she literally rolled her eyes at me and said, "Infinite Jest, every guy I've ever slept with has an unread copy on his bookshelf."
That's a beautiful story.
Yeah. And so I knew that was a lot of people's relationship with the book, is it's something you own and you try to start reading it, but you have to read hard for 2 months.
Yeah, it's like you make a commitment to read it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you put it really well, James. It's a relationship. I'm very lucky that I had a purpose. You know what I mean?
Like a reason to read.
Yeah, because there are sections where I think there's intentional reader antagonizing going on.
It's sort of a bit opaque in places, in a way.
I think he's challenging you to see if you'll stick with it. Mm-hmm. How much work are you willing to do to get to know me, you know?
Right. So given the iconic nature that he's acquired, and, you know, he's one of those tragic figures now and worshipped, even if people only fake read the book, really. Right. Were you intimidated at the thought of, "I'm going to play this guy"? Or, I mean, because people obviously see you. And I think our critic at The Hollywood Reporter said it was your best work since Freaks and Geeks. I don't even know how you feel about that.
Wow. Well, that's nice. That's really nice. To answer your first question, I was terrified.
Okay.
Yeah. Which was really exciting to me. And to be honest, I hadn't been terrified in a long time. And I think that is something that I was really, really missing. And I was terrified to do Freaks and Geeks. That was an important thing. And I was equally as terrified to do Forgetting Sarah Marshall for myriad reasons, as you can imagine. Mm. But I think that that's actually been something that's been missing from my work for a while, is being terrified and being out of your comfort zone. But I think, you know, the nature of this business for an actor is that once you have some success doing something, you're encouraged both financially and otherwise to do more of that.
Do the same thing over and over.
Yeah, or variations on a theme, you know?
Right.
And the nature of a TV show, which I absolutely love being on, is that it's repetitive. So I think I had gotten into a cycle for about 5 or 6 years where things were starting to feel really repetitive to me. And I reached a point where I wasn't interested, which is a really scary place to get to as any kind of performer,
right.
I think.
Burnout type of thing.
Yeah, just why am I doing this? And then this script came along and I looked at it and I thought, this is why. This is why you continue to do this.
So when you were called to do this, were you saying to your agent or whoever, "I want more serious stuff, I'm getting a little bit fried on comedy"?
It wasn't so much comedy as much as I knew that I just wanted to make a change and do stuff that I really cared about. Yeah, and so I had sort of put that idea out into the ether to my agents, to myself, which is a big one, you know? And I was on a plane when right before we took off, the email arrived saying, what do you think of this? And I read it as I flew. And what I thought was, there is no way that they will ever offer this to me. Mm. I don't even know why they're sending this to me. Is it to make me feel bad?
It's an evil joke.
It's like, you should read this. Daniel Day-Lewis and Edward Norton are doing it. That's what I felt like when I read it.
Right.
And when we landed, I called and I said, well, that script is, that is a bullseye. And they said, would you want to play David Foster Wallace? And I said, yeah, of course. Of course I would. And they said, well, why don't you get on the phone with James Ponsoldt? And so we talked on the phone, and I was too nervous to try to feel out if this was being offered to me. Like, I still didn't know exactly what was going on. And we talked, and there was sort of like a what felt like, are we going to do this together? I think that's what he said. And I called and my agents and I said, is this real? And they said, yeah, I think if you want to do it, you can do this movie. And I was really scared because what I knew was, now is where you put your money where your mouth is. Here's what you wished for. You've been telling yourself, I should be doing this kind of material. And there's a chance that right now I find out I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit, watching it at Sundance, you show up for the first time with the bandana on your head, and I had this little moment of, really?
Yeah.
And then it just disappeared very quickly.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, well, that was what I was afraid of. Well, okay, so then we shot the movie, and I just worked as hard as I possibly could. I just read everything. I had an amazing dialect coach. I sort of isolated myself for 3 or 4 months in a house in the middle of nowhere and just prepped. I actually, if this makes sense, I thought about what I imagined actors that I look up to would do and just copied that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I didn't have a context for how you prepare for something like this.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, I get a dialect coach, I read every day, and I just did those things. But when we wrapped, I felt like, okay, well, now it'll get sent off into the world and I'll find out if it works. But I did the best I could. So now all I have to face is reality. And when we went to Sundance, my big fear is exactly what you said, that I would come on screen.
There he is with a schmata on his head.
Yeah, that for whatever reason, people would just say no.
Right.
And it, as of now, knock on wood, that doesn't seem to be what's happened.
That certainly hasn't happened. Did you make Jason test, James?
No, I just found him totally compelling, and just rewatching and then talking deeply with AV and the producers, just watching this footage of Wallace at that time in the mid-90s, it was like, Jason's going to be perfect for this. Mm. Other people might not know it yet, but he really is going to be. And after the first day of shooting, you know, Jesse Eisenberg came up to me and he's like, Jason's really great. Jason's really great.
Oh,
I was like,
did?
Yeah. I was like, yeah, I know. He is really great.
Jason's like, why didn't you tell me that before? Yeah.
But no, and it was a wonderful feeling of having this movie in the can and then just being able to edit it and having this knowledge that you were giving a deeply moving performance. You took such a chance on the movie and on the role. It's remarkable.
Oh, thanks. You know, I have to say, like, he says so naturally, like, oh no, I could see that Jason would be capable of this. That is really, really rare for somebody to see past all
right.
of these
categorized
preconceptions.
People.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He believed in me more than I would have believed in myself. I haven't had that experience since Judd Apatow. When I was 17 or 18 years old, saw me in an audition and said, I think you can do this. And I also think you can write. And I think if you write something where you're the lead in a movie, you could be a romantic lead in a movie. That's not how I felt about myself.
Right.
You know?
You need those people in your life.
Yeah. And James altered the course of not just my career, but potentially my life, you know, which is an amazing thing.
Coming up after a short break, James Ponsoldt and Jason Segel talk about the opposition to their film from David Foster Wallace's family and estate. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps, available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with director James Ponsoldt and actor Jason Segel, who plays author David Foster Wallace in the new film, The End of the Tour. Jesse Eisenberg plays David Lipsky, a journalist interviewing Wallace for a magazine profile.
What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country, that sort of thing.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No. I'm okay. How are you?
Because I'm terrified.
More than a year ago, the David Foster Wallace Literary Trust and Wallace's family issued a statement saying they did not support the film and Wallace would never have approved the idea. Ponsold says that came as a surprise.
You know, it was one of those things where we had finished shooting the movie and no one had seen the movie.
You hadn't reached out to the estate.
There had been a dialogue, yeah.
Because they had claimed, I think, that they didn't know that the movie...
No, they did. I mean, Anonymous Content optioned David Lipsky's book years before. David Lipsky wrote an article about Wallace that won a National Magazine Award, wrote the book with the support of Wallace's family. They're there in the acknowledgement. So... yeah, there was help. But, I mean, it's complicated, like with any family. And, you know, we knew the movie we were making. We also knew that, you know, we were making David Lipsky's story. We weren't making a biopic. I think the interesting thing, sort of when people initially talked about, you know, online about the movie, they assumed this was going to be a cradle-to-the-grave biopic about David Foster Wallace, which obviously it's not. It's a hyper-subjective story
right. Based
on David Lipsky's book, which was widely read, and about how he was impacted
by
Wallace.
About a few days, really, in the life of, yeah.
So we just proceeded with the work and knew that, like, people would see the film eventually and the truth would be there. And then it could be judged on its own objective criteria. People would like it or not, but people would see what the story actually was and what the value system was of the people making it.
They didn't try to stop the film.
No.
So it didn't cause you any kind of actual problems, except maybe you would have liked them to reserve judgment.
Sure.
Now, I don't know how many actors you looked at or thought about, but he was a big guy. Mm. And Jason, you're a big guy. How important was that physicality to you?
You know, it was important. I mean, you know, Jason and David were both ex-athletes. David Foster Wallace famously was a, you know, tennis player in his adolescence and wrote about tennis a lot. Jason was a basketball player. There were physical attributes that were sort of uncanny. But I think, you know, Jason can speak about this more. It was really important for us that we weren't just doing... you know, an impression, you know, that this wasn't a sketch. It was much more important, I think, to understand the essence.
And I assume you weren't trying to mimic. I mean, you know, we've seen Truman, you know, Capote, where it's very, you know, it seems like he's trying to channel,
yeah. You
know. I don't know, to what extent were you saying, I want to try and be David Foster Wallace?
Well, I'm going to answer that kind of abstractly. I felt like, first of all, specifically, it was important to be as close to the physicality and to a speech cadence,
and mannerism, yeah.
Mm-hmm. that you could be to honor that this is a real person who has a family and people who love him very much and is a recognizable public figure. But what I really tried to do was I feel like David Foster Wallace in his writing is operating under the premise that we are all the same fundamentally. And so I tried to really focus in on the parts of me and David Foster Wallace that are the same and build around those.
The connectable part.
Yeah, as opposed to trying to build something outside of myself.
I mean, it's sort of in the casting, you know, I think from a distance for a lot of people, they think of David Foster Wallace, they think of him as a tragic figure.
Right.
Who also wrote a large and challenging book, you
yes,
know?
Yes, that's pretty much the takeaway.
Yeah, they know how he died. But, I mean, the interesting thing is that when you really look at footage of Wallace, when you read him and when you look at footage, he did a lot of interviews, and a lot of them are online. And he, you know, there's a great interview he did with Charlie Rose in 1997, which was a year after our story takes place.
Well, I think he said he regretted ever doing it, didn't he?
Maybe, but what you see is, you see exactly how funny, how radiant, how you know, he self-edits, but he's charming, he's seductive, he's, you know, Charlie Rose clearly has just a deep affinity for him. Do you know what I mean? There's a real... lightness, and he's a profoundly funny guy.
Which is important.
Which is very important.
Yeah, I actually think that in an attempt to honor David Foster Wallace by deifying him, you strip away what is most important, which is that he's you.
Yeah.
He's you with an amazing facility to express the things that you're not able to express. That's how I felt.
I think, yeah, I mean, seeing him either as a tragic figure or as a saint, which are two things that I think... you know, it's this binary approach to sort of a very complicated guy. You know, he was someone who worked very hard as a writer, and he was a complicated guy. And that's how we attempted to portray him.
Who came first, the Jason or Jesse?
I don't remember exactly. I mean,
because the chemistry obviously is the key to the whole thing, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I don't know if you. I'm totally blank on whether you have done things with Jesse in the past.
No, we didn't meet until we were getting, we met for one day when we found out we were both doing the movie. And then the next time we met was when we started shooting.
Wow, that was, did you deliberately keep it minimal?
I think a lot of it had to do with schedule. I started shooting this movie the day after I finished How I Met Your Mother.
Head snap.
Yeah.
It's kind of perfect, though.
Yeah, it really was. I think that it happened to work really well in our favor, though, because the first scene we shot together was the scene where David and David meet.
Right.
And
so that strangeness was real.
Yeah, and I was scared, and how will this go, and what's Jesse going to be like, and who's going to act better in this scene? All of those things that you go in with.
Which fits in the jousting between the two of them. It works in the movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the movie is based on David Lipsky's account. I mean, it's David Lipsky's story of his time, his brief encounter with David Foster Wallace. They were strangers when they met. They didn't stay in touch afterwards. So really capturing that newness of two people feeling each other out was something we wanted to capture on camera.
Now, Jason, don't listen for a minute. There's been some awards buzz around the movie already. You're coming out in the summer, which is not the normal time. Did you get to vote?
Yeah, I'm thrilled. I mean, A24, you know, our distributor, they're great partners. I mean, they distributed The Spectacular Now. You know, Spectacular Now was one of the first films, along with Bling Ring and Spring Breakers, that they sort of took out when they were a new company. So I believe deeply in them. And I think they know strategically how to take them out into the world. And I think they have incredible taste. I'm not saying that just because they put out my movies, but I love the movies that they make.
Really? That they put especially out. Especially the ones? Yeah, okay.
But I mean, for myself, I felt like this was a great time. I mean, we're opening in New York and Los Angeles on July 31st, and there'll be a nationwide rollout as the weeks go on, as people are going back to school. I don't think that's accidental. I think the movie, you know, the movie is funny. The movie is a hangout story. You like hanging out with these guys. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as the film gets into its third or fourth week of release, you know, people will be back in school, which I think is a really great time for this film. You know, releasing a film like this, obviously this is a complicated discussion. I think releasing it in November or December at the height of award season, I think a movie like this could get lost. It really could.
Right.
It's an independent film, and it needs to be discovered and championed. And if we're fortunate, the audience will be there, and they will tell their friends about it, and it will still be in the conversation months from now, but we can't control
that. It's not like, yeah, you're not the only potential awards film to open. You know, Boyhood was earlier, I think, than this.
Yeah.
Do you care, Jason?
No, I'm not really savvy about that stuff, and I know that that sounds like a
sort
dodge. No. Yeah, but it's actually not. You know, I have a sense of how to make a movie.
Right.
The strategy after that, I sort of leave to the people who know what they're doing. My real focus, honestly, is I want to do this for the next 50 years, you know, and I would like to tackle great, challenging roles. And so for me, anything that helps in that direction is just a wonderful thing. But the end goal for me is I would just like to do this consistently.
Longevity.
For a long time. Yeah. I really love acting, so it's how I'd like to spend my life.
Jason Segel is the star and James Ponsalt is the director of The End of the Tour. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.